The Puritan Start, A Christian Civilization. The first talk in a series on Christianity in America was presented by Tim McIntosh on February 20, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
My name is Tim McIntosh. I teach at Gutenberg College. The class is Christianity in the United States, or the history of the church in the United States, however you want to title it. Here's the way I'm going to do this class. Since we've only got 10 weeks, there's no way I can do anything close to a comprehensive or a really systematic history of Christianity in the United States. So I've picked those 10, the 10 classes that I'm going to do are going to focus on the really big events, personalities, themes, movements in the United States. So I'm not going to cover, as an example, much about the Orthodox Church in the United States, the Eastern Orthodox Church, just because even if you belong to an Orthodox Church, you probably acknowledge the impact of the Orthodox Church in the United States has been relatively small. I'm not going to go into too much detail about the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church's influence in the United States has been pretty significant, especially in the last century, but it still is not nearly as influential as Western European Protestantism is. So I'm going to stick to Western European Protestantism until we get into the middle part of the 20th century, when demographically things just change pretty dramatically in the United States. So that's kind of rough of the plan. Now, let me just give you the 10 classes that I'm going to do, like I was telling Michael before class started, so you can kind of cherry pick which classes you want to come to. Even though I really am serious, every one of these classes should be worth your time. You're gonna hear, hopefully in every class, something, and you'll recognize yourself in this particular trend, or you'll recognize your family or the church you grew up in or your worst enemy, whatever it is. You're going to recognize different aspects of who you are and what your social milieu is in these different classes. I have structured these 10 classes to be basically the church's response, Christians' response to particular challenges. That's the way I'm kind of organizing it. So what happened in churches when the Industrial Revolution hit the shores of the United States? This changed everything about the United States. Every aspect of life has changed pretty dramatically. Basically, people are coming in from farms and they're going into cities. And it's happening very, very quickly, and it's happening to a huge proportion of the populace. So what did the church do to address that? Those are the sorts of challenges that I'm going to try to be structuring the class around. So here are the 10 classes. Today, two parts to class. The first part is basically answering this question. If you're not a Protestant or a Catholic in Western Europe, if you want to do something that's a little bit different from Protestantism or Catholicism, what are the different options that are open to you? Then I'm going to focus on one particular Protestant group whose influence in the United States is, as far as I can tell, without peer, the Puritans. So maybe 30% of the class is going to be devoted to these other options that are not Protestantism or Catholicism strictly. The rest of the class is going to be about the Puritans, because they left this legacy that is still around today. The second question or challenge that I'm going to address in week two is, can we get along when we've got now Lutherans and Catholics and Protestants living right next door to each other in the United States? How are we going to get along? Are we going to be able to survive? Because in Europe, what's happening when Lutherans and Catholics come in contact with each other? They're shooting at each other. They're stabbing each other. They cannot get along. So what happens in the United States to enable different denominations or sects to get along? Question three in the third week is, should colonial Christians reject their spiritual parent, England? And a second question, is Christianity rational? Because there's a big movement in Europe, and it kind of comes to the United States. rationalism, or basically we'll call it philosophical humanism. There's a few different names we can give to it. I'm going to call it rationalism. And we'll see rationalism show up in the deism of the founding fathers and in other ways in the United States. Then I'll just give one more class. I'm not going to go through all 10 after all. Fourth class will be, can Christianity convert the common man? This is a really big question because the population of the United States explodes in the middle part of the 1700s, and there's a huge awakening in the United States that results in, amongst other things, Christians barking like dogs, falling on the floor and thrashing about. Second Great Awakening is a really pivotal moment in American church history. And a second question that we'll deal with is the question of, is Christianity progressive? The middle of the 1800s begins kind of a progressive movement in the United States and in Europe, and Christians are asking themselves, is Christianity progressive? Is it fundamentally conservative? Which direction do we go? And we'll meet Marxists. We'll see the church try to respond to industrialism. And we'll see a bunch of utopian societies pop up in the middle and late part of the 1800s. Very interesting utopian societies, because there's kind of a real deep sense of optimism at this time in Western civilization. So I'll just leave it at those four. They're bound to change a little bit, because depending on how far I get in each class, but I'll just leave it with those and we'll jump into class. Any questions before I start? Okay. Let's start a little bit with the Western European background. The United States, the first settlers, non-native to the United States, are overwhelmingly Europeans. They are overwhelmingly Western Europeans. They are overwhelmingly Western European Protestants. If you are a Western European, around the time that this new world is discovered, the Catholics and Protestants have been duking it out for a little while now. And so I want you to just suppose that you are one of these people who is kind of, maybe you've got an allegiance to either the Protestants or the Catholics, but you're also not quite sure that either one of them are right. They each have their own kind of authorities. They each have their own leaders. And maybe you're kind of unsure which direction you're going to go. You're sort of the mythical undivided voter in presidential elections, the undecided voter in presidential elections. Like, I've never met an undecided voter. So this is a similarly kind of like a mythical creature in Europe at the time. Someone who's not necessarily a Protestant, not necessarily a Catholic. Three different groups pop up in this kind of in-between space between Protestants and Catholics. I'm going to talk about them now because they'll each exert a tremendous influence in the United States in subsequent centuries. The first group says this. Look, the Protestants and the Catholics have been fighting, and not just fighting, but it seems like there's no resolution in sight. And all of these doctrinal disputes are not only leading to a lot of hurt feelings and territorial wars, but tons of deaths, tons of deaths. So you're part of this first group, and you say, well, how do I solve this problem for myself? If I'm not going to side with the Protestants or the Catholics, how am I going to solve this problem for myself? This group says, well, the thing that I need to lean on is kind of the inner light within me. Just kind of an inner spiritual light that I need to look to for guidance. So there are three spiritualists that become really influential in Western Europe and later in the United States: Jacob Boehm, George Fox, and Emanuel Swedenborg. You probably heard of George Fox because George Fox College or University is about an hour and a half from here. Jacob Boehm is a German mystic. He lived from 1575 to 1624. He had these visions in 1600 in which God revealed to him the nature of the universe. He was looking at a pewter dish, and a bolt of sun came in, strikes the pewter dish, and he sees like the very structure of the universe. It's a revelation from God, and he's not really excited to go tell people about this. He knows that people are not going to be terribly thrilled to hear this, so he sits on it for a while, but gradually, a little bit later in life, he begins writing things down and having conversations. And a lot of people gather around him and they say, you're really on to something here. We believe this was a very genuine vision from God. And so Jacob Boehm, like the other spiritualists, there's some direct communication that God is having with him and with his followers. There's some sort of an inner light that has not been corrupted, like the reformers say, by original sin. There's something pure in us that we can kind of listen to or that we can see. George Fox, he dissents from a lot of the religious authorities of the day, and he founds his own religious community known as the Religious Society of Friends, or because George Fox urged his followers to tremble at the word of the Lord, also named Quakers. George Fox also had a sense that there was an inner light, something God could communicate, or there was some spark of God within us that if we concentrated on it, if we could see it, it would be revealing. It would lead us toward truth, toward spiritual truth, toward moral truth. Last one, Emanuel Swedenborg, 1688 to 1772. He's a Swedish scientist slash philosopher who received a series of visions which culminated in revelations from God, urging him to write down a new church dogma and to reform Christianity. How many of you guys, I'm just curious, have ever heard of Emanuel Swedenborg? Okay, only a couple of you. I had heard of Emanuel Swedenborg about 2 years ago. He's not a major figure in European religion, but I at least heard of him. And I was walking down the street in Washington, D.C., where my brother and sister-in-law live, and I look over, and there's this huge, beautiful church right in the middle of Washington, D.C., not far from the U.S. Capitol, and it says out on the sign, Swedenborgian Church of America or something like that. And I thought, what in the Swedenborgian church? And so I told my brother a little history of Swedenborg and who he was, and my brother kind of teased me. He said, yeah, Anna and I knew that you would know what that church was about just because you're kind of obsessed with American church history. And so, yeah, it's a funny thing. Yeah, a testament to obscure knowledge in some way. So I'm going to call this first group, who all kind of look toward an inner light or an inner revelation from God, as the spiritualist. Now, this is not like a school. This is just more of a movement. The spiritualist, there are different strains, and it's just more of a movement focused on looking inward to solve the whole dilemma of what do we believe. Second group, how do we resolve this dispute between the Catholics and the Protestants? Well, they say, well, the main problem between the Catholic and the Protestants is that they can't agree about who the authority is or what the authority is. The Catholic Church says it's church tradition and it's church leadership and it's the Bible. The Protestants say, no, it's the Bible and it's the Bible alone. They're disputing over this. What are we going to do? We've got to solve this issue of authority. We're going to trust our own intellects. So these are, I'm going to call this movement kind of the rationalist movement. The rationalists, I'm gonna say that René Descartes, so middle of the 1600s, is kind of a proto-rationalist. René Descartes believed in God, was a pretty religious character, but he starts moving away from what would be traditional religious authorities and looking to his own mind to solve these problems. So in the middle of the 1600s, the rationalists are a very small group, and they still tend to be religious or have religious sympathies. But by the 1700s, this kind of strain separates itself from Christianity, and it'll eventually blossom into what we would call the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment project kind of has its roots in rationalism. Third group. How do we resolve the dispute between the Catholics and the Protestants? We do it through a simple, obedient, quiet Christian life. Whereas spiritualists sought inner light, this group strives to find a third way through personal piety, personal Bible study, private prayer, humble daily living. These are the pietists. Their leader is a man named Count Zinzendorf, And according to Count Zinzendorf, the true mark of Christianity was a simple childlike faith in the blood of Jesus. These pietists of these three groups are probably going to have the biggest influence on modern day evangelicalism. Pietists are tremendously influential on the evangelicals. They're also very influential on a group called the Moravians, who will be so influential in the life of John Wesley, it's sometimes hard to separate the two of them. John Wesley encounters the Moravians on a ship when he's crossing the Atlantic, and a big storm blows up, and the Moravians are all calm. They're totally cool. They're not worried about it at all. John Wesley freaks out, and he later goes to the Moravians, and he says, "How are you so calm? Teach me." So John Wesley, who ends up becoming the founder of the Methodist Church in the United States, deeply influenced by the Moravians, by the Pietists. All three of these movements will exert tremendous influence on Christianity in the subsequent centuries. But for now, we're going to go back to the Catholic and Protestant debate, and we're going to focus just on one particular group of Protestants, and those are the Puritans. Let me give a justification as to why we're going to just follow the Puritans. They are not the largest group to found a colony in the United States. They were not the first to arrive either. But historians, church historians, non-church historians, kind of widely agree that the United States is a continuation of the project that the Puritans began. Now, if you hear that, that probably sounds kind of strange for you, because we don't seem in any way today very Puritan. That might be because when you hear Puritan, you hear strict, strict morality or something like that. The case that I'm going to try to make for you guys in telling this history is that there's a lot more to the Puritans than just strict morality. They were very, very concerned with their individual moral standing before God, but they had a lot more going on. They were a really vibrant intellectual community. And so I'm going to try to make the case to you that the United States is kind of picking up what the Puritans tried to begin. All of the problems that the Puritans experienced are in some ways the same sorts of problems that we experience today, albeit in a very different form. I'm going to quote Alexis de Tocqueville a lot. He wrote a book that's in the Gutenberg curriculum called Democracy in America. Correct. And he's really quotable. He's just, Michael, he's great, isn't he? He's one of your favorites. Didn't he write you?
Yeah, thesis on.
You wrote your thesis on him. So you can probably finish these quotes for me. I'll start the quotes and you can finish them for me. Here's the first one of many. You'll hear many during the course of this class. First one from Alexis de Tocqueville. The destiny of America was embodied in the first Puritan who landed on these shores, just as the whole human race was represented by the first man. That was 1835. Here's another historian. The growth, triumph, and transformation of the Puritan spirit was the most fundamental movement of the 17th century. Puritanism was the true English Reformation, and it is from its struggle against the old order that the unmistakably modern world emerges. One more quote. The decades before and after 1700 were a moral revolution that lasted long after the Puritan settlements had ceased to be strictly Puritans. Okay, so who are the Puritans? In 1604, the Puritans get a chance to meet with King James I. If you're Scottish, you'd call him James VI. At this meeting, the Puritans are extremely excited, very optimistic. James had just inherited the throne in 1603 from Queen Elizabeth I, who, but in the Puritan mind, was just an equivocator with regards to religion. England was going back and forth between Catholicism, Protestantism. Elizabeth comes along and she kind of equivocates and says, let's just have some peace for a change. Most everyone in England says, great, except for the Puritans. They're not wild about this. So after she leaves the throne, after she dies, James I enters, and James I seems to be leaning Protestant. He seems to be leaning toward the Reformation, toward the Puritans. They meet at Hampton Court, and the Puritans basically want one thing. They have a bunch of different proposals that they're going to present to James I, but they're chiefly interested in one thing. They want a Presbyterian or a Congregationalist church structure. Are you guys familiar? I'm going to talk about what those two things are. A Presbyterian church structure is basically an elder-run church. It's a church that stands by itself. It's run by a group of elders. But if there's some sort of a dispute, let's say in the church, over doctrine or behavior or something like that, there's a series of courts, ecclesiastical courts. And so a pastor who, I don't know, has some sort of doctrinal dispute, he's out of keeping with the teaching of his church, he could be trumped up on charges, but he could appeal to this Presbyterian court and he could get a hearing. If he fails in a lower court, he can appeal to a higher court. So the Puritans want either this system, the Presbyterian system, or they want a Congregationalist system. The Congregationalist system is pretty simple. It's just kind of pure democracy. The church members vote on who they want as a pastor. They vote on where they're going to build a building, if they're going to build a building. So it's a much more democratic style of church organization. Now, the church structure of the Anglican church looked very, very Catholic to the Puritans. And they did not like this at all. So a little bit of background. In the continent, in Europe, the Reformation had lit in 1517. You all know the event, what happened in 1517. Theses on the door. Martin Luther nails his 95 theses to the door, and Europe just catches fire. This has been the match that everybody's been waiting for. The match strikes, and all of people's frustration with Catholicism, with the Catholic Church and the abuses. Now we've got our spokesman. It's Martin Luther, and the Protestant Reformation takes off. But that's what happened in the continent. In England, something different happened. It was kind of Reformation light. What happened was Henry VIII, forgive me if you guys know the story. I've heard this story so many times, I can't tell the difference between what's common knowledge and what's unique. So I'm going to cover it anyway. Henry VIII, King of England, badly wants to have a male heir, but his wife has only produced one surviving female. So he, meanwhile, has fallen in love with another woman, Anne Boleyn, and he wants a divorce. He petitions the Pope for a divorce, and the Pope says no. And so Henry VIII, like any good red-blooded monarch would do, decides, I know what I'll do. I'm just going to start my own church. So he wants to start his own church, both so he can get a divorce, because Parliament's going to do what he wants them to do. And there's a little bit of a land grab involved. There are some disputed lands between England and the Catholic Empire, and he wants to grab those lands. So he gets both the divorce and those lands in one fell swoop, and he begins the Church of England, the Anglican Church. The trouble is, the structure of the church is Catholic. It's got Henry VIII on the top, and down from him there's an archbishop. Down from the archbishop, there are several other bishops and dioceses, and there are priests below that. So it's a very top-down sort of organization. And the Puritans don't like this at all. They don't like Catholicism light. They want a real Reformation to hit the streets in England. So when they go and meet James I at Hampton Court, this is what they want. They think they can have a real Reformation if they get church structure changed. So what happens at Hampton Court? I'm going to make you wait a little while. This is like a cliffhanger. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the Puritans. The Puritans, what did they believe? They are, in most ways, just like the Reformers, particularly like John Calvin's Reformers. So, but they also share a lot in common with Luther's Reformers. So they believe in the big three tenets of the Reformation, which are that the scriptures alone, not church tradition, not church authority, but the scriptures alone are the authority for what we should believe and how we ought to act. Sola scriptura, second major tenet of the Reformation. How are we saved? How do we escape? How do we have eternal life with God, and how do we escape hell? Only one way, through faith. Through faith. Not by performing religious duties, not by sacraments, not by taking holy orders, none of those things. It's through faith alone. If you ask the reformers which of the three tenets, I'll tell you what the third one is in a second, which of the three tenets of the Reformation are the most important, I think they'd probably say faith alone. That's the centerpiece of the changes. I think the longest lasting effects are probably this third one, which is the priesthood of all believers. So no longer, say the reformers, do you need an intermediary between you and God. You can pray directly to God. You can, if you can get a hold of a Bible, read the Bible and determine what it says for yourself. And this will be very influential on the Puritans. There is no divide between a sacred life and a secular life, meaning the Catholic Church kind of split things apart. And they would say, if you want to live a spiritual life, that's fine. You take a spiritual occupation. You become a priest. You become a monk. You become a nun. But a baker or a cobbler or a farmer, that's secular work. God's not terribly concerned about that. So for the reformers, this is tremendous. This is earth-shattering. The reformers come along and say, God is equally concerned with your plight if you're a farmer or if you're a pastor or a priest. So that divide between secular and sacred collapses with the reformers. So those are the three big tenets of the Protestant Reformation: sola fide, sola scriptura, scriptura, priesthood of all believers. So the Puritans share those things with the reformers, but they also have a more specific task in mind. They want to purify the Anglican Church according to strict biblical interpretation. Now, before I get a little bit deeper into what the Puritans believe, let me kind of clarify a few misnomers about the Puritans. I still hear that, have this kind of gut reaction when I hear Puritans. I think narrow, moralistic, teetotaling, sexless do-gooders. That's kind of what I hear. And there's a famous H.L. Mencken quote. H.L. Mencken was a journalist from the early part of the 20th century, and he says, somebody asked him to define Puritanism, and he says, Puritanism is defined by the haunting fear that somebody somewhere must be having fun. That's Puritanism. So this is just a caricature. This is just a character of Puritanism. They were very serious about their morality. They were not teetotalers. As a matter of fact, some of them did a business in rum. Of course, they wanted to practice drinking in moderation, and they would fine Harvard students. Harvard was begun by the Puritans. They would fine Harvard students for drunkenness, but they weren't teetotalers. The Puritans did not hate sex. Apparently, it was fairly uncommon, but it did happen that Puritan wives would approach pastors and say, "My husband won't sleep with me." The pastor would then go to the man and say, "Listen, you need to sleep with your wife." And if the problem persisted, the wife would take it to the whole congregation. And on a couple of occasions, there were excommunications because husbands would not sleep with their wives. One leading Puritan preacher, William Gouge, said, "Married couples should engage in sex with goodwill and delight, willingly, readily, and cheerfully." Go Puritans. So what did they, so that's what the caricature of Puritans was. Let's talk a little bit more about their doctrine. With the Swiss reformers, they believed strongly in original sin, that people were spiritually debilitated from birth and unwilling and unable to meet the demands of God and enjoy his fellowship. With the reformers, they believed in the supreme authority of the scriptures, as I said, as the guide for belief and practice. Here's how they differed a little bit from the rest of the reformers. The Puritans thought of themselves as being like the ancient Israelites in this way. God had made covenants with the ancient Israelites. Noah, Abraham, David. He made a special contract with them. The Puritans believed that they also had a unique contract or covenant with God. Where did they get this idea? They got it first and foremost from the scriptures. When Jesus is having his last dinner with the disciples, he takes a glass of wine and he says, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you." The Puritans thought that the Catholics had broken that covenant through idolatry, through sin, through all the abuses that they were reacting against. Now they, the Puritans, wanted to renew this covenant. So the idea of a covenant came both from the scriptures, but also from the second most popular book amongst Puritans. Anybody have any idea? If you were a Puritan and you could afford one book, it was a Bible. If you could afford two books, this was the second book. Any guesses about what that book was?
Pilgrim's Progress.
Good guess. It wasn't Pilgrim's Progress. Excellent guess, though. Fox's Book of Martyrs. Do you guys know Fox's Book of Martyrs? Ever looked at Fox? John Fox wrote a book detailing all of the many reformers who had died at the hands of the Catholics, and the Puritans loved this book. Within the book, the author, John Fox, seems to indicate that he thinks that God has a special and unique plan for the Puritans, for the English reformers. So the English reformers, the Puritans, see this covenant with God as they're kind of a special people. They're keeping alive the Reformation. And keep in mind, this is not just keeping, just reforming. This is not like a little denominational dispute. This is keeping alive the true faith in the world. For the Puritans, the stakes can't be any higher. So when they meet with James I at Hampton Court, the stakes are through the roof. This is really important to them. It's not just important for their survival of their own personal doctrines. This is the survival of Christianity, of the true faith. They meet with King James I, and the meeting is, according to the Puritans, an absolute failure. They get nothing of what they want. Well, they get one little thing. King James agrees that he'll make a translation of the Bible into the English vernacular. The Puritans don't really care. It becomes, as you all know, the King James Bible. The Puritans care, but it's not the central thing that they want, which is a change in the structure of the church. Soon after the conference, an anti-Puritan named Richard Bancroft was appointed to the head of the Anglican Church. So the Puritans say, there's another strike against us. Then King James's son, Charles I, takes the throne. Charles I takes a Catholic wife, Henrietta, a French princess. So the Puritans are beginning to see that, like, all hope is lost for them in England. To compound matters, the reformers in England are looking at the reformers on the continent. There's a huge war going on between the Catholics and the Protestants, and the Protestants are losing. The Protestants are probably losing because they're undermanned and underfinanced, but that's not how the Puritans saw it. The Puritans saw it as God was punishing the Reformation on the continent for their sins. It was falling into some sort of immorality of some sort. So here's a quote by John Winthrop, who's a Puritan leader at the time. He writes a letter to his wife. "The increasing of our sins as a people gives us great cause to looking for some great scourge and judgment to be coming upon us. The Lord hath admonished, threatened, corrected, and astonished us, yet we grow worse and worse. So, just as his spirit will not always strive with us, he must give way to his fury at last. He hath smitten all the other reformed churches of Europe before our eyes, and hath made them drink of the bitter cup of tribulation even unto death. He is turning the cup toward us also. And since we are last, our portion must be to drink the very dregs that remain. My dear wife, I am verily persuaded that God will bring some heavy affliction upon this land, and that speedily." So you can hear in John Winthrop that the failing of the Reformation on the continent is coming to them, and they're going to get the worst of it. They're going to get the worst of it. So there are two kind of central passions for the Puritans: purifying the Church of England and keeping the Christian faith alive through moral integrity. These two passions drive them in 1630 to board a ship in Southampton, England, and head for the New World. There are about 400 Puritans on board. Keep in mind just a little distinction. The Puritans are not the Pilgrims. They have things in common. Does anybody know the difference between the Puritans and the Pilgrims? The Pilgrims are the ones who land on Plymouth Rock. The Puritans are the ones who land in Massachusetts Bay. The difference is, very simply, the Puritans want to reform the Church of England. The Pilgrims are separatists. The Pilgrims are like, we are done with you. We're separating ourselves from the Church of England. So they share a lot in common, but on that issue, they differ sharply. Yes. Are the Pilgrims also Puritans? Yes. Yes. It's just that one difference between them that makes them Pilgrims or separatists. The Puritans are hoping to join the Virginia Company, but they're blown off course. They end up going much farther north than they planned. They end up in what will become Massachusetts Bay. Before they leave, a speech is given to them by a man named John Cotton, who's one of their leaders. And there's a phrase in this speech that becomes one of the most quoted phrases in American history. Presidents to this day use the quote or use the phrase. City upon a hill. Have you ever heard that used in American rhetoric? We shall be as a city upon a hill. John Adams has used the phrase. Abraham Lincoln has used the phrase. John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton has used the phrase. Here is the section of his speech that includes the phrase city upon a hill. And you can just, if you understand this, you'll understand so much about what is driving the Puritans to come to the New World. John Cotton says, they're like getting ready to step on the ship. We shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. If we deal falsely with God in this work we have undertaken and cause him to withdraw his help from us, we shall be made a story through the world. We shall open the mouths of enemies to speak evil of the ways of God. If our hearts shall turn away so that we are seduced and we worship other gods, our pleasure in profits, and serve them, we shall surely perish out of the good land. Therefore, let us choose life, that we and our seed may live by obeying his voice and cleaving to him, for he is our life and our prosperity. They sail, and many people follow. During the 10 years after they leave for Massachusetts Bay, more than 20,000 Puritan men, women, and children take part in the Great Migration to the New World. Now, the Puritans have arrived in the New World, and the big question is, now what? Because they can do, in essence, whatever they want to. They're going to start a Christian civilization. That's the goal. This whole, like, separation of church and state notion that they'll have, like, police and magistrates and leaders that do their job. You know, they make sure that people don't steal stuff, but will be concerned with more churchly things, with more moral things. That is not a split in their mind. This is all going to be part of the same tapestry. There's no divide between sacred and secular for them. They're going to start a Christian civilization. How do you do it? First thing you do is you establish a church, or you establish a system of churches. They opt for the congregational system pretty frequently. The congregational system is kind of the more democratic of the two options they had. These churches run their own affairs. They tax the community for financial operations. They hire and fire their own ministers. Think about how novel this is if you're coming from the Anglican Church in England. Hire and fire your own ministers? run your own affairs without somebody up there, some like aristocrat, some governor, some priest, some archbishop telling you what to do? This is unbelievable. This is great. Church attendance, of course, was mandatory for any sort of involvement in local elections. So if you wanted civil rights, like being able to run for office or vote, you had to be a man and you had to be a regular church attender. But not everybody was worthy of attending church. Each member of the community would have to endure a really rigorous religious examination of his beliefs to determine if you qualified to be a church member. I mean, the test was so intimidating, very demanding. It was so demanding that it only worked for one generation. The sons and daughters of Puritans are just like, are you kidding me? Really? So they back off after a generation. They're like, we're a little bit heavy-handed. We'll back off. They read Paul's strictures against women speaking in church strictly. So everyone had to give a conversion story in front of his or her church, but women's conversion stories would have to be read by a man. All of life is sacred to them, and all of life is worship. They build meeting houses that avoid a central sacred space, like a communion table. That's out. That kind of shows that there's sort of a hierarchy. For the Puritans, it's all even. There's not a one particular space like the communion table that's more sacred than the rest of it, like a Catholic church. No. Their meeting houses are very, very democratic in their architecture even. I'm talking about Puritans. Now, the Separatists may have done a similar thing, but I'm trying to just focus on the Puritans. So Madeline just asked if I was talking about the Separatists. In what sense are they purifying the Church of England? Because it sounds like they're just doing their own thing, right? They're in the New World and they're doing their own thing. What they want to be, they want England to look at them and say, oh, wow, they've got it right. Let's bring them back and let's do what they're doing. So it's all with a very deliberate purpose of kind of like making England jealous. So at the beginning, at least, when there's still hopes that England will turn around, reform its church structure, go through a real reformation, they're not really hoping or expecting to stay in the New World for a long time. They're expecting to be called back to England and say, what you did there, do for us here. That idea does not last very long. And I'll talk for a second about how that hope kind of falters. In like the next 30 years, it falters.
Yeah, it's starting to become apparent that based on the way that you're describing the Puritan government and community, not simply the Separatist, but the Puritan. Yeah, it's starting to bear a lot of resemblances to ancient Athens in terms of, in order to have a voting, to have voting privileges, you needed to be an active member of a community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in ancient Athens, in order to be an active member of a community, you had to have time on your hands to participate in the ecclesia or assembly. Now, in Massachusetts Bay, you needed to be a churchgoer, and again, first generation, there is that church test you had to do to attend. So only those who went to church had a chance to, by effect, participate in the running of community.
Yeah, that's right. And so people look back at Greece as kind of the birthplace of democracy. A lot of people look at the Puritans and they'll say, like, the seeds of democracy are there also. So that's, I think, a good observation. There's a lot of overlap. There are some similarities between ancient Athens and the first Puritan establishments. Let's return to this idea of a covenant, that God had made a special covenant with the Puritans. The Puritans tended to see covenants in all of their social and political dealings. So they believed that the ultimate authority in politics and religion was, of course, God's word, but the commitments made to a particular congregation and community was made through voluntary obedience to covenants. And this would ensure that the system functioned, right? You couldn't just pick up and leave if you were a Puritan. You had made a covenant to these particular people. You were kind of, and it was a serious covenant that you were undertaking. Here's a quote from Harry Stout, a Yale professor of church history. Mobility and atomism, think individualism, mobility and atomism, the chief threats to stability in the New World, were minimized. As churches came into being only by means of a local covenant, so individual members could be released from that sacred oath only with the concurrence of the local body. Persons leaving without the consent of the body sacrificed not only church membership, but also property title, which was contingent on local residence. Through measures like this, which combined economic and spiritual restraint, New England towns achieved extraordinarily high levels of persistence and social cohesion. But this is so strict, it just becomes untenable for the Puritans. We'll see. It's not long at all before this is just not, they cannot do business this way. This, the shorthand for this way of kind of contracting with a local community slash church is called the New England way. And it doesn't survive more than a generation or two amongst the Puritans. Okay, let's talk briefly about conversion. Think about the change that has taken place in from Catholic Europe. If you were a Catholic in Europe, there are all sorts of ways by which you could see, smell, taste, feel that you are making spiritual progress. You took the sacraments. You were baptized. You made confession. You went to church. These are all like very tangible things, if you're a Catholic, that would show, that would denote spiritual progress. Now, all of these things are ripped away if you're a reformer, right? All of these things are gone. So it leaves this question of, well, if I'm saved by faith alone, that's great, but how do I know that I'm saved? How do I know I'm of one of God's elect? How do I know this? It becomes this kind of like, imagine yourself in that situation. That would be kind of psychologically, you could be a little bit concerned for your salvation. So conversion, like giving one's testimony or giving one's personal history of conversion becomes very important for the Puritans, not just for their own individual sake, but for the community's sake. So to become a member in church and thus be able to vote, and thus be able to run for office, et cetera, you had to give an explanation of your conversion. You had to kind of give an account and a narrative of what happened. And for the Puritans, they looked to two guys primarily as kind of the pinnacle of what it looked like to become converted. Paul in the Bible and St. Augustine. Do you guys know St. Augustine's conversion story? He wrote a book called The Confessions. It's maybe the first autobiography in which he gives a detailed account of how he goes from being a pagan to converting to Christianity. And it's great. It's a great read. And Augustine is just plagued by these sins that he cannot escape from. He tells the story of he and a bunch of his friends walk past a pear tree when they're young men, and they're kind of horsing around, and somebody, you know, dares Augustine to steal a pear, and he does it just for the pure thrill of doing wrong. He doesn't even want the pear. I think he gives the pear to his friend after he steals it. He doesn't even want the pear. He just wants to do wrong. Augustine had a mistress that he kept for the longest time, and he could not. The sexual temptation was just overwhelming. He used to pray, God, save me from the sin, but please just not yet. Please not yet. The Puritans looked at him, and they just said, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what it should look like. striving to conquer one's sinful nature, to throw oneself upon God's mercy. That's what would be real evidence of conversion. Okay, let's jump ahead. Ultimately, the Puritans' deep spiritual commitment ended up cooling off with passing generations. The grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Puritans had not witnessed firsthand the abuses of the Catholic Church. They didn't know firsthand the stories from Fox's Book of Martyrs. They were moving on to other things. Their commitment cooled. So the Puritan system of mandating membership in church and taxing to support the church, it just can't last long in the New World. So 1662, 32 years after they sail and land in Massachusetts Bay, 1662, they develop something called the Halfway Covenant. It's a form of partial church membership in which first-generation settlers were beginning to die out, their children and grandchildren are expressing less piety, more desire for material wealth. So they kind of find this kind of halfway way to do it, in which you can have the benefits of a civic life without having full membership in a church. The Puritan community, I'm going to talk about kind of their legacy. I'm going to talk about the positive things that they left, but I'm going to talk first about three black eyes in the Puritan community. The one that's best known for us is, happens about 30 years after the Halfway Covenant, about 60 years after they land in Massachusetts Bay. This is the Salem outbreak of 1692 and 93. Puritans were very, very sensitive of the effects of witchcraft and demons. They were always on the lookout for witches and demons. A group of teenage girls begins trying to predict who they will marry in 1692. It leads, because they are accused of being witches, to 19 executions, 14 of them women, by hanging and pressing. For some reason, the judges in the cases seemed to be more credulous than usual and accepted specter evidence, kind of mystical evidence that these girls were involved in witchcraft of some sort or another. Finally, years later, or a couple of years after it began, Increase Mather, a distinguished New England clergyman, steps in. He's just like, okay, enough is enough. We've got to stop this. Something has gone off the rails. If you guys know the play The Crucible by Arthur Miller, this is a recounting of the Salem outbreak, the Salem witchcraft trials. It's also kind of a telling of the McCarthy trial, but the main storyline is following the Puritan witch trials. As you've probably picked up by now, the Puritans were not known for toleration of dissent. Facial branding with an H for heresy was not terribly uncommon. Flogging was more common for heretics. Quakers were persistently heretical. Two Quaker men and a woman were hanged in Boston in 1659, and Baptists like Ann Eaton were censured and excommunicated. Radical separatists like Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson were expelled from the community. Roger Williams will go on and start his own community, Rhode Island. Rhode Island is known for religious toleration, and thankfully, the middle colonies in the United States will follow Rhode Island's lead, and they will tolerate religious dissent. So the Puritan inability to accept someone that doesn't share their beliefs, it doesn't last very long. It just can't last very long. The third black eye on the Puritan community is they do not have healthy relations with the Indians. They did not believe that the Indians were inherently or genetically inferior, but because they were living without benefit of religion, they were mired in sin, deeply mired in sin. There were some attempts to reach out to the Indians by the Puritans. They always were kind of half-hearted. The Indians couldn't really present much resistance against the Puritans because about 14 years before the Puritans land in the New World, an epidemic sweeps through several Indian tribes and just decimates their numbers. In 1646, a man named John Eliot, a Puritan, starts several praying towns, which were settlements where Indians relocated, and they were founded to convert the Indians and help them learn English. These settlements were attractive to tribes who were suffering from intertribal warfare that needed help from disease and protection from other tribes. But John Eliot's communities were kind of uncommon. There are not many of those sorts of things in Puritan New England. So the Puritan hope that England would look at them as founding this vibrant Christian community and they would be called back to England, that idea rallies. There's a moment in English history in which the Puritans think, ah, this might be the time. They might call us back. Expect the phone to ring. It's when Oliver Cromwell, who has very Puritan sympathies, comes to basically dominate the Commonwealth, the short-lived Commonwealth of England. So this is after the king has been ousted. Oliver Cromwell is not king, but he's in essence kind of almost as powerful as a king. He has very Puritan leanings. He kind of thinks of himself as a Puritan Moses. But the Commonwealth of England does not last very long. And furthermore, Cromwell just thought, man, Puritans, your ideas are untenable. There's no way this is going to work in England. So he just doesn't give them much of an audience. Then the second and third generation Puritans gradually lose the zeal of their parents. They don't remember the abuses of the Catholic Church, and there's a tapering off of passion. This prompts a long series of Jeremiads, strong sermons lamenting moral decline that help rouse the spirits of believers to live up to the Puritans' ideals. All right, let's close with this. These are the lasting effects of the Puritans. You can see, as Michael mentioned, kind of an overlap with ancient Athens. You can see the seeds of democracy in the Puritans. The Puritans gave us regular elections. They gave us the secret ballot. They gave us the first democratic institution, the town hall meeting. Every male church member had the right to speak. Decisions were made by majority rule. Here's a quote from Alexis de Tocqueville again. British settlers brought with them into the New World a form of Christianity, which I cannot better describe than by styling it a democratic and republican religion. The Puritans also left a great esteem for education. They founded Harvard University, and they are probably the first civilization in human history to achieve near universal literacy rates. Everybody could read if you're in a Puritan colony. But the most lasting effect of the Puritans was probably their moral vision, and this is what I mean by that. The Puritans put a new emphasis on personal confrontation with faith, with the God of the Bible. The Puritans demanded that people calibrate their kind of inner gyroscope. They demanded individual responsibility. Christianity was not confined to a spiritual sphere, to a religious sphere, like the monasteries of the covenants or the convents of the churches. But every aspect of life was God's, all of it. Here's a quote from a church historian that I'm also going to quote a lot, named Sidney Ahlstrom. Quote, formerly it was thought necessary to withdraw from the tainted world in order to develop the highest spirituality. Monasticism was the surest way to perfection. But now it was the life of withdrawal which was regarded as tainted and opposed to God's will. So the Puritans' faith is a very active faith, very concerned with life in this world, not just life to come. All right, let's end there. I've gone a little bit over time. I've got books to read if you're interested in. I've just got recommendations. There are certain church histories that I think are really wonderful, and there are certain authors on American church history or the Puritans in particular that I'll recommend if you want me to recommend them. Sam, do you have a question?
Nope.
Okay. Any questions? Thoughts? Dynamite, I have answered all of your questions. All right, next week is the First Great Awakening. Do not miss it. Thank you.